From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Living together is becoming a rite of passage for American couples, it seems. More unwed Americans are living together than ever before. For some, it's a chance to test drive what marriage would be like. For others, it's a financial necessity. This hour, On Point, Cohabitation Nation. You can join us on air or online. Are you cohabiting? Why? And how's it going? We want to hear from you. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter or on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now are Sharon Sassler and Amanda Jane Miller. They are the co-authors of a new book, Cohabitation Nation, Gender, Class, and the Remaking of Relationships. You can find an excerpt on our website, onpointradio.org. Sharon is in Ithaca, New York. She's a professor of policy analysis and management at Cornell University, where her research focuses on family formation and change, including cohabitation, marriage, and the progression of romantic and sexual relationships. Sharon, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Yes, and Amanda, meanwhile, joins us from Indianapolis, Indiana. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Indianapolis. Her research focuses on non-marital cohabitation, gender roles, and relationship progression. Amanda, thanks to you for being with us.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Well, Sharon, let's begin with you. Can you give us, we threw out some notable statistics there at the top about how many couples are living together before they get married. Give us a little bit more of a sense, a sort of a profile of this cohabitation phenomenon that you and Amanda write about.
Well, in contemporary America, cohabitation has become a normative transition into adult life. So the majority of young adults and increasingly a large proportion of previously married and older adults are living together without being married. So the most recent data from the census indicates that about 18 million U.S. adults are cohabiting as of 2016. Over half of these are young adults under the age of 35, and the numbers keep increasing. So the more people cohabit, the less stigma there seems to be about living together. And there are a variety of reasons that people give for why they're living together without being married.
And one of the things that you and Amanda point out is there's some very clear differences, both along age and social class lines in terms of how many couples are living together.
Yeah, so one of the reasons we were interested in doing this book is that a lot of the press talks about how cohabitation is the new normal. But what has long been the case is that the less advantaged, the less educated have always been considerably more likely to live together without being married than the more educated. And it has become more prevalent among those with college educations. But what we were interested in exploring was how the process really differs between those with a college degree and those with less than a college degree. So I think saying everybody's doing it kind of doesn't allow us to understand what the very real differences are that are motivating why couples move in together and how these relationships unfold over time.
And Amanda Jane Miller, one of the things that caught my attention in your book is how you say that media portrayals of this phenomenon of cohabitation nation don't often include the nuance of social class differences. I think you say they portray it in through a kind of a middle class lens. And I think we actually have an example from our own network, NPR. NPR's Connor Donovan interviewed an unmarried couple who moved in together in Washington, D.C. back in 2014. And here, Charlie Charbel explains what he likes about living with his girlfriend, Claire Noble.
I get to hug her when she comes home. I get to kiss her goodbye in the morning. The fact that we both now actually get to save money because we're not spending half of our paychecks on rent.
And Amanda Jane Miller, that is, I think that is a good characterization of sort of a middle class view, right, of what cohabitation means to some couples.
That's very true. We often get a middle class or an upper middle class story of what this is like. But Sharon and I found it very important to talk about both sides of the coin, what this is like for those with less than a college degree as well. You know, since the election, there's been a lot of talk about the dwindling economic fortunes of those who have a high school diploma or just some college education. And what we've discovered is that when you peel back the curtains of what's happening at home, they're often facing situations that are just as precarious as in the workforce.
You write, and go on about the differences along social class in terms of not just why couples cohabit, but also, you know, the consequences of them cohabiting, the implications of them living together without getting married.
So one of the things that we're finding is that the reasons why couples tend to move in together are very different based on social class. And I'll let Sharon tackle that in just a moment. But really what's happening here is that the service class, or those who are less educated, are often being pushed into cohabitation long before they're ready for it. And as a result, the experience of cohabiting itself is very negative. They see it as something that made their relationships worse. And as a result, they can't figure out why on earth would we get married. If cohabiting made things so much worse, marriage is going to make it even worse still. And in contrast, the college-educated are able to take their time and able to move in more slowly and with a partner that they're more certain about. And so as a result, cohabiting made things easier, just like the interview that you played. It made things better for them. And so they expect that in the future, getting married or tying the knot will actually make things even better still.
And Sharon, you write about something called a cohabitation effect. And if I understand it correctly, you have found that couples who cohabit before marriage on the whole, are less satisfied with their marriages and more likely to divorce than couples who do not. I'm sure that that finding also breaks down along social class lines, different findings for different social class members. Is that right?
Well, actually, among the studies that were done among early cohabitors in the 80s and 90s often found that cohabitors expressed less satisfaction with their relationship than marrieds. I think as we see that cohabitation has become more normative, those differences have narrowed. And in particular, if you only cohabit with the person that you go on to marry, we don't see these kinds of differences, right? So in part, we have to catch up with the changing nature of cohabitation. It's a moving target. However, what we see in our qualitative study is that there is a lot of tension associated with what are often very rapid moves into shared living, and those are far more common among the less educated, those who don't have these great jobs that allow them to maintain independent living. So in the clip that you played, the man talked about paying half of his paycheck on rent, and I'm assuming that he had a relatively decent job. If you are working in the service economy, it is very difficult to actually be able to afford independent living, especially in many of our expensive cities, on, you know, a minimum wage or slightly above minimum wage job. So we are seeing that couples who discuss moving in together rapidly because of financial necessity or because they got kicked out of their living arrangement or need a place to live, that might have a negative effect on relationship quality.
And in fact, you have some very important findings about how couples from, as you say, the service class differ in their experience of cohabitation from middle class couples. But I want to go back to sort of the media portrayals that we hear about cohabitation. We have a couple of examples from TV shows talking about this. First of all, this is from the HBO show Girls from 2013. Hannah, who's, of course, played by Lena Dunham, hosts a dinner party for her friends. And during the course of conversation, she asks Ray, who's played by Alex Karpovsky, where he's living since he was recently forced to move out of his apartment. And Ray's girlfriend, Shoshana, then makes a realization about their relationship. Here's the scene.
So you're staying, like, just different people's houses, different neighborhoods?
Well, now, you know, I'm kind of just divvying it up amongst my buddies, you know, just kind of a few days here.
Well, you stay with me a lot. I mean, he stays with me a lot.
Yeah, sometimes I stay with her, so.
Well, you kind of stay with me a lot. I mean, like, you're there on Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and then Thursday and then the week before and then the week before that. Oh, my God, do you live with me?
What'd you say?
And that's that shows how a cohabitation just sort of seems to kind of happen on its own, sort of under its own momentum. Would you say that's a kind of a middle-class experience, Amanda Jane Miller?
Well, many of our couples, regardless of their social class, were living together without really living together. So that is, they found themselves staying over more and more nights per week very rapidly. The difference here is that the middle class were often able to maintain separate residences because economically they could afford to do so. And in contrast, those who had less education often had to move in together because of some sort of crisis or emergency that occurred. So Josh and Patty, who we interviewed, were a good example of that. They moved in a lot faster than the two said they would have liked to. And in large part, that was because he didn't have enough money to live alone. And after leaving her parents' house, then she lived with her sister, and then Patty's sister kicked her out. So they moved in much faster than they wanted. And because they hadn't had time to work things out beforehand, they started struggling over housework and finances, and at times they weren't even on the same page regarding contraception. So the idea that we sort of stay over all the time definitely occurs among both social classes, but being forced to give up that other residence is much more common among the less educated.
You know, one of the other things that caught my attention, and either Sharon or Amanda can comment on this, is that in the service class, gender roles tend to be seen a little bit more traditionally. And it may be a matter of stress when you have a couple living together sharing housework or sharing income responsibilities. That creates a kind of a stress that may not exist for more middle-class couples. We're talking about Cohabitation Nation. Our guests are Sharon Sassler and Amanda Jane Miller. They are the co-authors of Cohabitation Nation, Gender, Class, and the Making of Relationships. You can find an excerpt of that book on our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about our Cohabitation Nation, where so many unmarried couples are living together. You can join our conversation. How do you and your partner talk about finances, having kids, the future? And with me from Ithaca, New York, is Sharon Sassler, a professor of policy analysis and management at Cornell University. And in Indianapolis, Indiana, is Amanda Miller. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Indianapolis. And I do want to talk about some of the implications of social class differences in the experience of cohabitation. You have some very important findings there. But first, let's consider some of the communication issues in any relationship, for that matter. In this episode of The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon, who's played by Jim Parsons, moves in with his girlfriend, Amy, played by Mayim Bialik. They try to communicate about their new living arrangement in this scene.
Which side of the bed would you prefer?
It doesn't matter to me. Your choice.
No, we're living together now. Everything's equal.
No.
I know that I have a tendency to be controlling, so I would rather you choose.
Well, Sheldon, I really appreciate that, but these things mean more to you than they do to me, so whatever you want.
Well, clearly it's not whatever I want, because what I want is for you to make this decision, and you refuse to do that.
Okay, well, here we have a couple trying to sort of play out a new relationship in their living together situation, trying to be very equitable. Sharon, you have pointed out, and we mentioned this before the break, that social class differences produce sort of different views of gender roles in a relationship. What's appropriate for the man? What's appropriate for the woman? Can you explain that?
Well, our middle-class college-educated couples, by virtue of having more education, have been more educated in the concept of equality and equity. And also, even though the majority of our women were working, the men still continued on average to earn considerably more than they did. So they weren't necessarily as threatened by the presence of having a working partner. That's less the case among our service class couples, where more of the men were earning relatively equal to what their female partners did. And this results sometimes in what we call a masculinity threat or a perceived threat to what are often considered the male prerogatives of being able to determine what they do in the house or not. Amanda, do you want to address this?
Sure, of course. So one of the things that we see historically throughout the research is that less educated men have often had more conventional ideas about gender roles than others. And what's happening here is two things for the college-educated. One is that the women are being more assertive. And so whether that's through what they've learned through college or through having roommates, you know, women that we interviewed, like Amy, were not afraid to ask – she wasn't afraid to ask her partner, Kevin, to pick up more of the slack at home. And also these college-educated men, like Kevin, are fairly readily acceding. So, you know, one of the men said – I don't enjoy cleaning toilets, but I also realize that she doesn't enjoy it either. And so since we're both working, it's only fair that I take on more of the share at home. And that leaves the college-educated women more satisfied in their relationships because they feel like they're getting a better deal.
And the fact that service class couples move in together for economic reasons rather than for romantic or relationship-building reasons indicates that service class people are having a hard time making ends meet, perhaps, than working class, as we used to call them, couples from 30 or 40 years ago.
Well, that's clearly the case because women are working, right? So it often takes two paychecks to afford your rent. And many of our less educated couples, the partners talked about how both of them were working. Some of them were working 40 to 50 to 60 hours a week and were still having difficulty with school debt and paying for rent and making car payments and just staying on top of living expenses. So we have a couple. Susan talks about how she couldn't afford to live on her own, and her partner says if Susan wasn't living with him, he would not be able to make his debt payments. So that's the case, yeah.
Well, let's bring some listeners into the conversation. A lot of you have thoughts from your own experiences. First of all, Alexa, who's calling from Boston, here in Boston, Massachusetts. And Alexa, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Tom. Well, the main comment that I wanted to make is that I feel like some of these issues don't even escape the middle class. My fiancé and I have lived together for about 4 years now. We got engaged about 6 months ago. We met when we both graduated from college. And at this point in our lives, we both have good jobs. But at first, we had the same struggles that you mentioned before, trying to figure out how to pay our bills and pay our college debt and manage having, an entry-level, low-paying job. But even though we did move together because it would be more affordable, we live in Boston. Boston's very expensive to, it's very expensive to live here. It was also about, seeing if it would work in the long run. We're both kids from divorced parents, and we wanted to see if we were both in an emotional and intelligent enough place in order to live together and have a prosperous future with one another.
Okay, Alexa, well, first of all, congratulations on getting engaged. You put 4 years of experience into this, so I'm sure you know what you're doing. But as you yourself acknowledge, one of the questions that you had is whether you could sustain this relationship for the long term, whether you could work out the kinks in your relationship. So my question is, what if you had decided over the course of living together that it wasn't working out? Would it have been as easy to break up when you're living together as it would have been if you were not living together?
Absolutely not. And I don't think that would be true for almost anybody because, when you get an apartment together, you're going into a legal contractual binding agreement with your lease. And most leases, if you do break them, you're going to have to pay a lot of money in cancellation fees for the lease and last month's rent, all that kind of stuff. So I don't think it makes it easier at all.
And Amanda Jane Miller, that's actually something you're right about, this kind of lock-in factor where there gets to be perhaps a little more rigidity in a relationship when you're living together.
That's right. It does become very difficult for couples to extract themselves from the relationship, particularly if neither partner really has enough resources to live alone. And I think your caller made a great point, is that in those first post-college years, there is a lot of financial struggle, but there's also a lot of hopefulness that better things are on the horizon in terms of moving up in your job or being able to earn more in the future. And that's not necessarily the case for the service class. And at the same time, thinking about when couples move in together is so, so important. You know, one of our service class couples moved in together within a week of meeting one another out of financial necessity. And so what's happening is those couples who are moving in very quickly are moving in during the very headiest days of that romance. And as those of who have been in a long-term relationship know, those first days aren't exactly representative of what happens throughout the rest of your union.
Yeah. Let's go now to Brandon, who's on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Brandon, your thoughts on Point.
Hi, Tom. I'm down here in Nashville, and I lived in New York City for 3 years and worked and played in the theater community. And I found it just interesting seeing a number of people find themselves living together because they don't want to, you know, travel on the train back home to get back to their home at 4 a.m. And, you know, rather when they're spending time with each other, they go, why don't we just go ahead and sign a lease? And then they would find themselves in, you know, sticky situations. If they were, you know, they broke up, they would end up, you know, having to find somebody to fill in, you know, that left that lease. And, just kind of was, thought that was interesting to, you know, with the intentions to save money, at the same time, I would find conflict, you know, at the end.
Yeah. So, one thing about marriage is that it is a real formal commitment. I mean, you stand up in front of witnesses and your family and you make promises to each other. Sharon, does that sort of prepare a couple sort of for the discipline, if that's the right word, of living together in a way that a more casual coupling does not prepare you?
Well, there aren't really clear, these kind of clear markers for cohabitation. So we don't have cards that say, congratulations on your move-in cohabitation date. Right. In fact, it's sometimes hard for couples to come to agreement on when exactly they moved in because it's much more of a sliding kind of process. Many couples say that they are testing this out or they're not yet ready to have that level of formal commitment. And we also have a fairly substantial proportion of people who are anxious about the divorce, the possibility of divorce. So Amanda and I have written a paper called The Specter of Divorce. And like Alexa, your previous caller, many people, whether their parents have been divorced or not, are concerned that relationships might not they may not make it. So it is less formal. It's easier to get out of, many of our respondents say, than a marriage. And so they think that it will enable them to try things out for better or for worse.
Well, let's go now to John, who's calling from Frederick, Maryland. John, your thoughts on cohabitation. Thanks for calling on Point.
Hi, Tom. My girlfriend and I, we just recently purchased a place together. And it really came from the idea of the marriage and the marriage ceremony is so expensive that at this time that it was just not really financially smart to invest so much money with not some kind of full financial reward in the end, if that makes sense.
So you sort of justify this financially. You're not talking about your emotional preparation for marriage, or what about the possibility of it not working out?
Well, I run the possibility of it not working out even if we do get married.
Yeah. So
and even then, that will still be a sticky, messy, expensive situation. So it's more of a don't brood on decision makings with the possibility of it not working out and just keep kind of plowing forward, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Any thoughts, Amanda or Sharon?
Certainly. So he is definitely right. The average wedding has gotten substantially more expensive over time. And one of the things that we're finding is that because of their family social class backgrounds, it is a real impediment, particularly for the service class. Now, for the middle class, there was more talk of family support, both the sort of instrumental support in terms of buying the dress or buying the flowers from the family, but also some emotional support. So sometimes the middle class often found that their family and friends were pushing them more toward marriage, so that kept the engagement rolling along. You know, one of our guys talked about his girlfriend's grandmother would email him regularly and say, you know, it's Flag Day, have you proposed yet? It's Martin Luther King's birthday, have you proposed yet? And so it's not just that they're supporting them financially in terms of helping that wedding proceed, but they're also encouraging the behavior as well.
Amanda, you are a sociologist, and I want to ask you a somewhat controversial question. You're probably too young to remember this, but about 50 years ago, Daniel Patrick Moynihan wrote about what he called the culture of poverty. You and Sharon quote Charles Murray, who sort of updated that culture of poverty argument. He seemed to, in your interpretation of him, blame service class people or working class people for the problems that they had in their lives. On the other hand, you and Sharon have also written that there are attitudinal differences, and I think that's your phrase, between service class couples and middle class couples that may explain some of the problems they encounter in building a family. Are you kind of resuscitating, in a sense, this culture of poverty debate?
We are most definitely pushing back against this particular culture of poverty debate. The difference here is that as a sociologist, we're really looking at the structural conditions that are leading to many of the differences that we might see by social class. So, for example, you know, finishing college has a lot of advantages, not just financial, but in terms of some of the attitudes you learn about egalitarianism, for example. And for our middle class, that's a little easier to do. They are able to get loans in a good way, or they're able to have family support financially as they work through college. For our service class, college was often very stunted. So they would enter college late. They'd have to drop out for a year or two to work or only attend part-time. And so what we're really saying here, and Sharon can add on here if she'd like, is that these structural conditions, the differences that people are experiencing outside of themselves, are leading to some of the attitudinal differences that we see.
Sharon, what do you want to add to that? I'm thinking of a quote from your book, and I don't know which of you wrote this. Service class cohabitors often failed to demonstrate mastery of important life skills increasingly central in both contemporary relationships and the work world, such as communication, cooperation, and negotiation. Those sound like cultural issues.
But they're learned behaviors that one obtains in a college classroom, for example. Mm. You learn to work to deadlines. If you cannot meet those deadlines, you get in touch with your professor and say, hey, I have four other papers due the same time. Do you think I could have an extension? We inculcate these middle class norms in parents of college-educated parents inculcate these from a very young age. Annette Leroux has called it concerted cultivation. And I have a teenager. I've been ensuring that he discusses if he has issues with his homework with his teachers from a long time ago. So you learn this middle-class, college-educated young adults learn this from high school on, and they learn if there's an issue that they should raise it. They learn how to discuss financial issues if they need to a much greater extent than do our less educated respondents, who are often told that they should be obedient and follow the rules and not necessarily stick their neck out and ask questions. And that means that when it comes to relationships, both men and women are less able to navigate what are often considered important prerequisites for middle-class life.
And just in a couple seconds, what does that portend? I mean, talking about structural constraints, what does this portend about the future of families?
It does suggest that we're going to continue to see this divergence in family behaviors. If we have less educated couples who move in together rapidly and are experiencing a lot of relationship strain and are less willing to transition into marriage, and those with college educations who experience cohabitation more positively and think that marriage is the next step, then we will continue to see this bifurcation among the more educated and the less educated.
This is On Point. I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about cohabitation and how it differs based on couples' socioeconomic class. You can join our conversation. If you are living with your significant other, how has it changed your relationship? Are more of your friends doing the same? And with me are Sharon Sassler and Amanda Miller. They're the co-authors of the new book, Cohabitation Nation: Gender, Class, and the Remaking of Relationships. And in their book, Sharon and Amanda point out how this is, for the most part, a phenomenon among young couples, or especially evident among young couples, but it is certainly not limited to young couples. We have from a listener on Twitter who goes by the handle Bola. Today is the 5th anniversary of us living together as man and wife, and the 10th anniversary of our first date. It's also the day we're going to the county clerk to actually get married. We delayed the actual marriage until a problem with the IRS was straightened out. And Bola says he is 70 and his wife is 66. Another comment on Twitter, this one from someone who goes by the handle Honest Debate. My wife and I were together 28 and a half years before we got married. There was no point really before that. So clearly it's not a phenomenon limited to young people. And let's go now to Kathy, who's on the line from Arlington, Massachusetts. Kathy, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, it's good to be here. My story is that my partner and I have been together for 22 years. He's 86 and I'm 76. And we both had had traditional marriages and nuclear families and knew each other for, I think, two or three decades. Well, we were both married to those other people, and then we both found ourselves single and were going out with each other and realized that we'd like to try living together and see if that would be good. But we also, from the beginning, knew we didn't want to get married. Why should we get married? There was no reason. If we had had kids together or something, we would have gotten married in a minute. But at this point in our lives, I had two reasons. One was that he had a lot of health issues, and I wanted to protect my precious assets from his nursing needs, so I didn't want to blend our finances. And then the other thing is that I'm a feminist, and I've been there, done that, of taking care of families and being the wife, and I'm not willing to be his wife. I want to be his friend, his housemate, his partner, but on an equal terms. I'm not willing for him to be a freeloader and me take care of him. So we have just taken it 1 month at a time, 1 year at a time for 22 years, and we don't have any more long-term commitment to that, and I think it feels right to him, but it definitely feels right to me.
Well, if you've been together for 22 years, that's, I guess, a good sign that it must feel right for him as well as for you. But I do have to ask you, Kathy, how does he feel about your concern that he could turn into a freeloader?
Well, it's kind of a daily issue about whether he does the dishes or not, since I do the food shopping and cooking.
But he doesn't. He apparently doesn't have any problem with you wanting to protect your assets from his possible nursing needs.
Oh, he completely supports me in that. It's likely that I'm going to live like 10 or 20 years longer than him, and he wants to make sure that I'm going to do okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks. That's an interesting story. And Amanda, do you write much about older couples who choose to live together for, again,
practical reasons very different from those that might compel a younger couple to move in together. Kathy's explanation was also very practical, but very different from what you might hear from a younger couple.
That's right. We really focused on those who were 18 to 36 because we were interested in the family formation decisions that they were making. But Kathy's story really resonates here in the idea of the practical. So we have to keep in mind that all of these choices, all of these couples are just really making the best choices that they see that are available to them at the time. And so there were couples that we interviewed that talked about being willing to marry for practical reasons. Slightly different, but the idea that if they needed health insurance, for example, and could be on their partner's health insurance, that would be a practical reason to marry. Among the college-educated, we're also seeing some who say that they'll marry for social reasons. So they don't see any real purpose to marriage. They maybe aren't particularly religious, or it doesn't seem like it's something that's necessarily for them. But they're also not seriously opposed to it. And so as a result, they're willing to get married to make their families happy or to be able to throw a big party for their friends. And so the practical and the social are really what we're seeing that are reasons that are driving at least some couples toward marriage, while, you know, of course, others really are excited about tying the knot.
Okay, here's another perspective from a listener, Francis, calling from Augusta Springs, Virginia. Hello, Francis. Thanks for calling On Point. What's your thoughts on this?
Yes, I've been an attorney for over 56 years, and I've handled hundreds, if not thousands, of family issues. And my experience has been that cohabitation just doesn't work. And on the bottom line is there's a lack of trust. They fail to make that commitment. Divorce rates right now are down to 35%. Cohabitation rates, from what I understand, are up in the 90s. And the old saying...
Excuse me, friend. Explain what you're saying. 90% what of what?
90% of the cohabitations end up broken up. In my practice, and I'm sure there's been more than that, two have lasted for a long period of time. There's an old saying that goes, if you're getting the milk for nothing, why buy the cow? It's a question of respect for one another. It's also a question of commitment. And this seems to be a lack of today.
Okay, I'll do a little fact-checking on your Francis there with Sharon and Amanda, who have actually spent a lot of time researching this. That sounds like a high figure, 90% of cohabiting couples.
It's very high. When we think about how cohabitations disrupt, they can either end in marriage or a breakup. And so, yes, most cohabitations are relatively short-lived, 5 to 7 years. We do know that the proportion of cohabitations that transition into a marriage has declined over time. So it's about 40% of cohabitations in the last formed in the last 5 to 10 years have transitioned into a marriage. It used to be higher. We also know that college-educated couples who cohabit are considerably more likely to marry. So over half of college-educated couples who cohabit marry within 3 years. It's a lot less for couples with lower levels of education. So you have to think about what's the end goal, right? Is it, you know, so most of these cohabiting unions will transition into something else. That is not to say, though, that disruption rates are not higher for cohabiting couples than for marrieds. They are. And Francis mentioned the decline in divorce rates. We have also observed that, right? So we do know that the college-educated are also less likely to divorce. So they're more likely to marry when they cohabit. They're less likely to have children within their cohabiting unions and more likely to wait until after they're married. And their marriages are more likely to persist, to last. So we do see a strengthening of the family among the college-educated. We're not seeing that necessarily among the less educated.
Well, I hear you making an important point, Sharon, which is that just because a cohabiting couple breaks up doesn't mean that that cohabitation didn't work out or failed. I mean, if a couple chooses for sort of casual or practical reasons to cohabit and then ultimately split up, does that necessarily mean that the whole venture was a failure? Amanda, what are your thoughts on that?
Definitely not. As cohabitation has become a normative part of the courtship process today, it's no different than couples who would break up from a dating relationship. Now, of course, it's more complicated because you might have a shared lease or you've bought a sofa together or you have a dog. But at the same time, this is one way of screening out potential long-term matches. The other thing that we need to remember is that while it's still not as common in the United States as it is in Europe, there are a fair number of couples who intend to just live together forever and never marry. So some of the couples that do persist are one thing, but others, you know, maybe screening out a bad match before you're legally tied together in so many ways isn't a terrible thing.
I'm curious about one thing. You know, one of our callers said that they didn't get married earlier because of an IRS issue. Mm-hmm. How do you talk about the differences between the United States and Europe? How do U.S. laws and tax laws affect, the feasibility of getting married or the advisability of not getting married? Either one of you. Well,
if you're thinking about a European comparison, there's a lot of variation among countries in Europe. So you have the Scandinavian countries where they have basically equalized marriage and cohabitation. France would fit in there as well. But then you have countries like Germany and the UK where there are still differences between marrieds and cohabitors in respect to how they're treated by the law, right? We had many of our couples who did talk about financial incentives or disincentives to getting married, so they see both sides. But among young people who are still pursuing education, marriage is often seen as something that they cannot do because, for example, if their partner is still going to school, they can't get financial aid to the same extent. So many of our laws actually serve as impediments for younger couples who might want to get married.
Let's go now to Erica, who's on the line from here in Boston. Erica, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm a young college-educated woman. I moved in with my girlfriend about 3 months ago. We've been together about 2 years. And I've noticed that the norm from at least where I went to school, I went to a small women's center college in Boston, that couples who are, together for at least, I'd say even 6 months, just tend to move in together. And then, like your people on your show are saying, it either works or it doesn't. And that just seems to be the norm for people around my age. I've seen it as young as like 18. And then once you graduate, you continue to live together. You get a cat, a dog, whatever, and then you get married.
And would you say that you got married or you moved in with your girlfriend, Erica, for practical reasons, for financial reasons, or because you actually wanted to, share a living space and be together more intimately?
I would say practical reasons and because we wanted to share a living space. It made sense for us. While we went to school together, we lived our original housing was a little bit far apart, and the way our work schedule worked out, we were just like, you know what? We're never going to see each other if we don't live together. And it would feel like long distance, even though we lived about 30 minutes away from each other,
yeah,
which isn't technically long distance, but just practically it made 100% more sense for us to move in.
Amanda and Sharon, have you looked at same-sex couples much in your research on cohabitation?
We have not. In fact, there was another researcher who was initially working on this topic, and we were hoping it would be a big part of what we're doing. But one thing that we can tell you is that, in general, same-sex couples tend to be more flexible in terms of gender roles. So there's more egalitarianism, but there's also more structurally dependent things. So, for example, if one partner has to pick up some extra slack at work, the other partner might take on additional chores at home, and then things could easily flip the next week. And so it would be really interesting to do a larger-scale qualitative analysis of same-sex couples to see how their experiences of cohabitation differ.
Let's go now to Megan, who is on the line from Salem, Massachusetts. Megan, thanks for calling On Point.
Hi, Tom. I was calling with a comment about where I'm actually cohabiting with my now fiancé. We've been living together for going on 4 years. And when we first moved in with each other, we actually moved in to the in-law apartment of his parents' house. It made a lot of sense for us at the time. I was going back to graduate school, so it was a great way to save money. But now, 4 years later, I'm done with my graduate program. I'm back to working full-time. And we recently got engaged. And so people have started asking me, okay, when you're married, are you still going to live with his parents? And I actually think the answer for now is yes. It's allowing me to pay off some of my student loans. We pay cheaper rent than we would if we lived in an apartment on our own. Hopefully we can save a little bit of money for the wedding or for, you know, a house that we can own someday. And quite frankly, we really like the intergenerational mm-hmm. lifestyle, you know, that it allows us to have. We get along great with his parents. And, you know, thinking ahead to the future, depending on how long this living situation lasts, if we have kids,
yep.
you know, it's like built-in babysitters.
Well, I assume your fiancé's parents approve of your arrangement and welcome you in their house.
Yeah, very much so. It's actually great to have them living right just upstairs from us. It's not only are they family, they're also like landlords who are just really super nice and maintain the apartment for us.
Okay, interesting. Well, a quick final comment from either Sharon or Amanda. You know, my parents would not have approved of me living with my girlfriend, but, you know, that was a different generation.
We find that a substantial proportion of our couples are actually living with other people, and some of them are family members. So some of our couples are living with parents. In fact, the ones who get along well with family members are the ones who are more likely to get engaged and transition to marriage. So I think it's a win-win. It's a plus that they already can assess that they'll have good relationships with their in-laws. And congratulations, Megan, for being engaged and for finishing your graduate degree.
A quick final thought, Amanda?
Absolutely. So one of the things that Sharon and I both find really important is that if we want to help diminish this social class gap, if we want to build strong families across the spectrum, affordable housing and a living wage so that service class couples are more able to control when they move in together, when they're able to have children, and do things on the timetable they feel is best as opposed to the one they're forced to do is very important.
Very important. That's Amanda Miller. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Indianapolis. Thanks, Amanda, for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks to Sharon Sassler as well, professor of policy analysis and management at Cornell University. Thanks to you, Sharon.
Thank you, too.
You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, Netflix is content king, but can they remain at the top with Disney and Apple in the game? I'm Tom Gelton, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.